From WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
My mother didn't like what I did because she thought it was mean to the restaurants. She used to say, a man opens a restaurant, he spends all this money, and it's successful, and one day in walks Big Mouth. My father was afraid someone would kill me.
I'm so excited for you to hear this show today. Food writer Mimi Sheridan is a legend. She's pushing 90, and she's just so wry and knowledgeable and just plain hilarious. We talked live on stage about her life as an eater and the time she had 104 different pastrami sandwiches in the car with her. She was opinionated, as always, and when I tried to disagree with her, she put me in my place. You don't mess with Mimi. From WNYC, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're coming to you live from Food Book Fair in Brooklyn, New York. My guest today has been a food writer for the better part of six decades and was the first woman to hold the position of New York Times restaurant critic. She's known for her toughness. She stood her ground when she was physically accosted by a French chef who didn't like one of her reviews. She later said, I'm sorry I didn't hit him in the face. So. She's also known for her thoroughness. Before writing about Bloomingdale's food department, she tasted every item in the store, all 1,196 of them. It took her 11 months. Her latest book is called 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and it took her 10 years to complete. Please welcome the one and only Mimi Sheridan. I want to spend a little time at the start here, Mimi, just sort of recounting the tale of the Mimi Sheridan origin story. Do you remember when you first realized that the food was more than something that you put in your mouth to stay alive?
My whole family was about food. My mother was a very good cook and tended to evaluate other women on their ability to cook. My father was in the wholesale fruit and produce business in Washington Market, and he would come home at the end of the day and talk about the various fruits and vegetables that came into him from all over the country. And he had very strong opinions about which was better regionally. And I think that began to develop a certain discernment. We sat and analyzed what we were eating that night, and he was talking about, you know, lousy apples from the West Coast, the nights aren't cold enough, and so on. So I never thought of being a food writer. I didn't know there was such a profession.
But it sounds like both of your parents had strong opinions about food.
Absolutely. They were all critics all the time.
Would you guys have debates around the table?
Yes, yes. My brother or I would say, I don't like it this way. And my mother would say, that's the way I'm always going to make it. Too bad for you. So it was like, and then when going to restaurants a lot, we would say, you know, you make it better or this is great or something like that.
So you were like bred from a very young age, even though you didn't know it was a profession at the time. Like you found your call, like you were bred to do this.
Yes, I think so. I think so.
Is there something in your new book, In 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, that you can, something specific that you can trace back to the formative years? Is there a little bit of teenage Mimi Sheridan in there?
Well, there's certainly a lot of my childhood and my mother's cooking because she cooked Eastern European Ashkenazi Jewish food, things like chicken soup and chopped liver and Manhattan clam chowder, which was very big in our house. And those things of your childhood stay with you. When I began to make a list of things I was going to put in 1,000 foods, the first two things I wrote down was frozen Milky Way and caviar. And I think that kind of defined the limits because it's not only the expensive and exotic things that are delicious and wonderful and have memories, it's many of the humble things as well.
You have 1,000 foods in this book, but you started with a list of twice as many.
Yes, I had just about 1,800. I just sat down and started writing.
Do you remember what the 1,001st food on the list was?
Yeah, I remember because it's something that was on my list at the first that I simply forgot to write. And it's Mapo Tofu, which is one of my three favorite dishes in the whole world. It's the Sichuan dish. Very fresh, lovely cubes of bean curd stir-fried with ground pork and mushrooms and lots of hot spices. And it was on my original list. I just forgot to write it. And when the galleys came, I said to the editor, "Where's Mapo Tofu?" She said, "Who?" And I had never written it. So every time I look at the book, I think I left that out. So that's 1,001.
All right. Well, Sporkful listeners now will know.
I'm glad you asked.
This is the director's cut, right, of the book. I want to get into your process for evaluating foods. And one of the things we do on the Sporkful is to talk about food and eating in ridiculous detail, which I know is something you've been doing for many, many years.
Ridiculous detail?
Ridiculous, yes. Maybe absurd is a better word.
I would say complete.
Okay. All right. Let's see. We're cut from the same cloth, Mimi. When you're eating a bunch of different versions of the same food in order to try to figure out which one is the best one, like I know you did a piece a while back about deli sandwiches. You had 100 different pastrami sandwiches in the same day or something. I mean, when you're doing something like that, how do you control for, like, there are so many variables. How do you control for the different variables? In other words, like, for instance, your hunger level at a given moment. Like, if you're more hungry when you try one than the other, then the one that you were more hungry for is likely to taste better.
Well, if you're doing that, you don't swallow them all. I mean, if you really want to test 10 pastrami sandwiches, maybe you would each take a bite of each. If you had 100 altogether, you would probably do what wine tasters do. But that's not the way I would do it. I would go to each place, have that sandwich, think about it, and then in the end, gather them all together for another look at all of them. I was once in a car with 104 pastrami and corned beef sandwiches.
Who was driving?
My husband. We were almost overcome by the aroma. But I thought I would round them all up on the same day because I wanted to have my butcher, who had a city-certified scale, weigh each amount of meat in each sandwich so I could see just from that standpoint who was giving you value. So I had to get them all on the same day, take them in, unwrap them, label them, you know, weigh the meat. So it's crazy.
That sounds perfectly sane to me. I don't think that's crazy at all. But in terms of evaluating that many different ones, I mean, you said you would even if you're doing it over the course of days, you're going to try it at this place, you're going to try it at that other place. Some days you're in the mood for a pastrami and corned beef sandwich, and some days you're not.
Doesn't matter if you're a professional doing it, whether you're in the mood or not. It's your work and you have to do it.
And you think you can get beyond personal desires and moods on a given day and hunger levels?
Yeah,
and...
yeah.
I'm not there
yet. You don't
yet.
Believe it.
No, I believe that you can do it, but I'm not able to do
well,
that.
Well, you're not a food critic.
That's true. I'm an eater. You know, they do these studies, I'm sure you've seen them, where they show that half of people who are paying for top shelf vodka can't tell the difference between the top shelf and the well.
That's
and they've done
true.
The same studies with the wine. Is there a certain percentage of people who go to these high-end restaurants just because they're sort of caught up with the status symbol that it is to say that they were at this place?
I'd say probably 80%. I really do. I think they don't know why they're there or what they're eating, but they read about it. So, you know, they want to go and try it. And maybe 80% is a little high, depending on the restaurant and the city and the power of the local critics. But there are a lot of people eating food they don't understand. It's become sort of status to be able to talk food the way once you were supposed to be able to talk art or know the names of actors or actresses and so on. And I think the press and social media and so on has made it the talk of the moment.
And how do you feel about that?
Well, there's a lot of it I don't listen to, but I think having the talk is good because it makes more people aware of food.
I went to a restaurant in New York, and I got two little kids. I don't get out much at all. This is a big day for me to be here. I'm very excited. So I don't get out much at all, and even less frequently to any kind of nicer restaurant. But I was really determined to get out to check out a restaurant in New York that was, you know, run by one of the top chefs in the city, who's known to be very innovative and creative, and went there, and it was...
Which one?
I don't really want to say, because I'm about to...
Oh, come on.
It was Alder.
So how was it?
Well, I mean, this is what... And look, maybe I'm in the 80% who just don't have a developed enough palate to appreciate the finer things. I will freely admit that that's possible. It was very delicious. Nothing there that I didn't like. Some things I liked more than others. But it was very expensive. Nothing there blew me away. And I left, and I remember walking out thinking to myself, nothing that I just ate was better than hot dogs.
Well, I love hot dogs, but I do have to disagree. There are many things I love at Alder and loved at WD-50.
At what point did you acquire, or maybe you always had it, like, you have a lot of, you have the courage of your convictions.
Right.
And at what point did you feel like you had earned that?
I don't know, as soon as someone put a pen in my hand.
Well, it's funny because, like, there are certain areas of food where I feel like this is something I spent a ton of time thinking about, and I've researched it, and I feel very strongly that I have an opinion that is worth sharing. Right. But there's other times that I'm like, this is kind of what I think, but maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. Like when I walk out of Alder and think I would have rather had hot dogs. And so sometimes I don't have the confidence to
be
like...
Well, you may not have the interest in the kind of thing Alder was doing, which is okay. I, being in this so much, I am very interested in what's going on. So I would go to a place of innovation, perhaps with a different feeling. You just want a good, delicious, familiar meal. I want to see what they're doing and then decide if it's a delicious meal. So I think it's just a different point of view.
It's funny because when I went there, I really thought I wanted something new and different. So I'm open to the idea of eating something
new
and different.
Did you have his pigs in the blanket? That's a hot dog.
Yeah, yeah. I did have that. I was really excited for the rye pasta, the rye linguine with the shave.
That's the pastrami sandwich.
Right. That was good. That was good. But it wasn't as good as a pastrami sandwich. Coming up, much more with Mimi Sheridan. She explains exactly how to eat a frozen Milky Way, and we'll discuss kale when we get to the lightning round. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. If you're enjoying this episode, check out our show on bagels featuring former Congressman Anthony Weiner and On the Media's Brooke Gladstone.
Having something called a bagel, which is really just a Kaiser roll with a gloss, it's a betrayal.
I mean, if at the very least your bagel is not bagel-shaped, you're probably off to a rocky start.
Also in that show, I ask a bagel historian, why do bagels have holes? Check out that episode. It's in the same place where you got this one. Now, let's get back to my conversation with legendary food writer Mimi Sheridan, live on stage at Food Book Fair. I want to talk about a couple of foods that are mentioned in the book in a little more detail, just which I picked partly for variety, partly really at random. You know, there's 1,000 foods. We can't cover them all. So bagels and lox. First, tell me about your ideal ratio, bagel to cream cheese to Nova.
Well, first of all, you have to find a good bagel, and that's very difficult. That's another subject, perhaps.
Well, we agree that bagels have gotten way out of hand. They're much too big.
What I usually do is scoop the inside out.
Oh, interesting.
And I leave a shell with just a little bit of the bready part. And then I would say the bottom half should be filled with cream cheese, then the salmon laid over it.
Filled until it's level? So you're scooping out the bottom and you fill
right,
cream
and
cheese
filling
up,
it
until
with
it's
cream
flush
cheese.
With the top of the
right.
bagel?
And then I put three or four very thin folded slices of the Nova Scotia or Scotch on that. Then a very light scraping of cream cheese on the top part. And then I put it together and press it down. I put pepper on. I like freshly grated black pepper on that.
Why more cream cheese on the bottom than the top?
It doesn't squish out all over when you press down on it.
That's also part of the advantage of having that sort of gutter in the bottom,
right.
that the walls around it will contain.
Right. There used to be a coffee shop in the Beverly Hills Hotel where a very famous counterman, Red, would scoop out the bagels, toast them lightly, and fill them with scrambled eggs. That was fantastic. But that gave me the idea of scooping out all the bread that I think is only good for cleaning wallpaper.
But let me throw another technique at you, Mimi. Because my one concern with the scooping is that then you lose too much of the chewy, doughy interior. I try something I call bagel trifurcation, where I slice it in thirds. You turn the bagel on its side. Instead of slicing once down the middle, you make two cuts and you remove a center disc.
You throw it out.
You could toast it.
But you don't make a club sandwich out of it.
Right, yeah. You remove it. But what that does is it reduces the size of the bagel, but it still preserves some of the chewy, bready interior.
I'll try it.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
All right. I'm gonna retire after that. Mimi likes my technique. Do you like your bagel toasted?
No.
Good.
You know, unless they're really terrible, as I say, you toast them and fill them with scrambled egg. But no. Maybe warm a little bit if they've been around a long time. I prefer them from the bakery cold, though.
Yeah, like, tell me if you disagree, but I feel like toasting fresh bread of any kind, like when it's fresh, toasting is something you do to bread that isn't fresh anymore to make it better.
No, I sometimes make toast for a sandwich out of fresh bread.
Okay, but not a bagel?
No.
Okay.
Not a bialy either.
You wouldn't toast a bialy?
I would never toast, never.
Final question on this food. What's the ideal temperature of each component, bagel, Nova, and cream cheese?
I would say almost room with maybe a little bit cooler for the salmon.
If you take the salmon out of the fridge and now it's cold and you're hungry right now.
I eat it.
Would you rather eat it cold or would you consider like 8 seconds in the microwave to take the chill off?
I don't have a microwave.
Do you think less of me because I put it in the microwave for 8 seconds?
Yes.
One other food to cover before we get to the final lightning round. Frozen Milky Way. What makes a frozen Milky Way so good?
I would say the marvelous way the textures melt down as you bite in and you have the experience of the chocolate, the caramel, the solid cream filling. It's just a wonderful, sensuous feeling on the palate and the very slow release of the flavors. And you have to be careful not to break your front teeth. When I freeze a Milky Way, I slice it first.
Before freezing?
Before freezing, and put a little piece of wax paper between each slice so you can peel it off without... I have crowns on my front teeth now, so I'm very sensitive about biting into frozen Milky Ways. It can cost $1,200.
Most expensive Milky Way ever.
Yeah.
Why frozen Milky Way over other candy bars?
Because I like it better. And we used to have frozen marshmallow twists, but I haven't seen those around in a long time.
I will say I personally prefer it refrigerated over frozen. What do you think of that?
I think it's different, and I think you're entitled to your choice.
All right, Mimi, are you time now for the portion of our interview that I'm calling the lightning round?
Go ahead.
All right. I'm going to say a word, and I just want you to give me your quick couple of sentence take on this. Ready?
Yep.
I wanted to have a sound effect that would go like, da, 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 but it was too much trouble. So just, we'll add that in post. Molecular gastronomy.
Interesting and not molecular.
Tasting menu.
Mixed feelings. A little over the hill as an idea, I think.
How many courses is too many?
I haven't had too many yet. I would say four is enough.
Yeah, these ones that are these 20-course tasting menus, you're there for 5 hours. You know, I can't.
Well, professionally, I like it because I get to try a lot, and, right. You know, and that's my job.
But do you ever feel like in those situations your stomach is on this, like, hamster wheel where, like, you walk in and you're hungry and you eat a little something and you're less hungry and then the next food comes and you're not hungry and then you wait and then you're hungry again and by the time you leave, you're kind of, like, not satisfied and not full and not hungry?
It has nothing to do with hungry. I haven't been hungry in 60 years.
Final word in this lightning round, kale.
Yuck.
All right, congratulations, you survived the lightning round.
How could I fail?
There's so much more wisdom in the book. It's called 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Please give a big hand to Mimi Sheridan. Well, it was really exciting, really an honor for me to get to meet Mimi Sheridan and to interview her. And I'll be honest, I was a little nervous beforehand because, I mean, she just has such a reputation for being tough and pointed. Like I said, you know, you don't mess with her. And she was, you know, very direct, but in the end, like, she was just so gracious and so nice. It was really, really great to meet her. And after the interview, there was a Q&A. We'll post audio of that on our website. Mimi was asked, "What's the most offensive food you've ever eaten?" So you can hear her answer at Sporkful.com. Next week on The Sporkful, I'll discuss effective buzz management with the author of You Suck at Drinking. And the women behind the blog Bitch Beer help me pair beers with weather forecasts. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or the podcast app or add us to your favorites. Whatever you got to do to make sure you never miss an episode, please do that. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheSporkful. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Special thanks to Lital Molad and Paula Schumann. We got help from Tim Ruggieri. Our engineer for this recording was Noriko Akabe. Thanks to Elizabeth Thacker-Jones, Kim Chu, and all the folks at Food Book Fair in Brooklyn for having me. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Russell Green from Murrells Inlet, South Carolina, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.